Today, there are about 100,000 children in the U.S. waiting to be adopted.
Adoption is a wonderful way to grow a family. There are wonderful children available for adoption here in Illinois, here in the United States.
That's Jane Turner of the Adoption Center of Illinois. We'll talk with her and an adoptive mom about how agencies are trying to help defray the costs of adoption. Plus, U.S. Representative Rodney Davis joins us to talk about his new proposed legislation that would also help adoptive families with tax benefits. Later,
while Facebook and Google have struggled to come up with an adequate fix for its fake news problem, a group of college students came up with a solution in just a day and a half.
That's CBS News. We'll talk with two of those students who are at the U of I about how they're working to weed out fake news online. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned after the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone enjoyed their Thanksgiving holiday, especially if you had time with family. Speaking of families, today there are more than 100,000 children in foster care in the United States waiting to be adopted. More than 1,000 of those children are in Illinois, according to the Department of Children and Family Services. Domestic adoptions can cost as much as $20,000. Think around double that if you're thinking about international adoption. Those costs put adoption out of reach for many who are hoping to grow their family. But there's an organization based in Chicago that's hoping to change that. They're known as Gift of Adoption. They help provide support to families with financial need. Throughout the month of November, that is, by the way, we are in National Adoption Month, the organization has been awarding a grant of up to $7,500 a day to prospective adoptive parents. The priority is those who are seeking to adopt some of our most vulnerable children. We're joined now by Ngezi Okorafor, who received a grant from a gift adoption a few years ago to help with the adoption of her son, who's now almost four. And also on the line with us from Chicago as well is Pam Devereaux, CEO of A Gift of Adoption. Ngezi, Pam, welcome to the 21st. Thank you so much for being with me.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting us.
Ngezi, let's start with you. What led you to decide to adopt your son? This was in 2012. What was behind that decision?
Well, like many women, especially working women in their late 30s, I just realized, time had slipped away. I suffered a number of miscarriages and even went through the IVF process and was unsuccessful. I was at my wit's end because I've always wanted to be a mother, and I became very open to adoption and learned a lot about the process, ironically, in my 39th year at 39 years old. Learned a lot about the process and went through the required steps to become a home study ready family, and really undertook the process in when I was 39 in 2012. And when I finally made the decision, as I tell my family and many of my friends who are very interested in my story, when I finally made the decision to adopt, I was actually matched with a birth mother. And for those of you who don't know, you need to become matched with a birth mother or father, or sometimes one or the other or both, in order they essentially select you as the family to place their child with. It's a very intense and emotional process, and I was very proud to have been matched with this birth mother. She actually lived in Florida, and I live here in Chicago, and I was matched from July through November of 2012, and as is her right, as is the birth mother's right, about a week before I was supposed to, the baby was supposed to be born, she changed her mind, and I was devastated. So I spent my Thanksgiving of 2012, I'm pretty devastated with my family, with my significant other. And as luck would have it, I immediately became matched with another birth mother who was exceptional. And a day before Christmas Eve of 2012, I hopped on a plane, flew out to Las Vegas, Nevada, got there just in time for the birth of my son. And the story goes from there. I will say the only way and the only reason I was able to hop on that plane and essentially stay in Las Vegas for 16 days as everything was finalized was Gift of Adoption. They awarded me a grant in the final moments right before I became a mother to cover my travel expenses to Las Vegas from Chicago in that last minute hurry. And you should see my son. He's almost four. He will be four on Christmas Eve, and he is amazing.
Mm. And I mean, as you say that, Pam, I wonder if you could fill us in. We talked a little bit about adoption costs. If someone's going through the process, like the process that Ngozi went through, do we have an average sense of how much that would cost? I know it can vary, of course, but for someone who's trying to adopt an infant in the same process that Ngozi went through?
Yeah, so we receive probably about 600 applications a year from qualified families in the United States looking to adopt. And for the domestic adoptions, I would say the average amount they're looking for the total cost of the adoption is about $25,000. And the cost is really driven by three key components. One is the travel, as Ngozi had suggested. A lot of times the children are not born right nearby, and as my friend likes to say, the first part of being home is getting there. So that's a huge process, and so that's part of the cost. The other part of the cost is the work that the accredited providers provide in order to really ensure that this is going to be a good fit for this child. Ngozi went through, as all people who go through the home studies go through, a really rigorous process of vetting them, you know, physically, financially, emotionally fit. And so there's real costs associated with that review. And then there's the third driver of cost, which is just the legal transaction of completing an adoption. You certainly need to get it right, and it's a very serious thing. And so there are costs associated with that, attorney's fees mm-hmm. to complete the adoption.
Ngozi, the process you went through, the vetting process, how long did that take and how much did that end up costing you?
I remember it very well, and Pam is extremely accurate in stating that it is rigorous, and they do a thorough evaluation for your physical, fiscal, and emotional readiness to be a parent. Mine began in January. I remember it because, again, 39 sticks out to me. I turned 39 in February, and I said, this is going to be my year, God willing. And it began in January, and it ended in August. That's when I say it, I'm referring to the home study process. That process entailed multiple visits with a formal adoption agency staff person who came to my home, had to review my finances, had to talk to me, had to talk to my family, had to get recommendations from non-family. That's important. You have to get three in Illinois. You have to receive three recommendations from persons who are not in your family as to why you should be a parent. It was very rigorous. And of course, they want to ensure that you are you have sufficient funds to raise a child, whether you're working, if you're married, everyone in the home has to be fully evaluated. So that took 8 months for me. Mm-hmm. And once you're home study ready, you can immediately go to an accredited adoption agency and affiliate with them, either in Illinois or some other state, and indicate that you're ready, you're home study certified to adopt.
Pam, you mentioned that you had around 600 families who have applied for grants for you all, and I understand that you all give priority to people who want to adopt children who are considered most vulnerable. What does that mean? What does vulnerable mean?
Right. The 600 is 600 a year around the country. And the most vulnerable is really referring to kids for whom this just may be their one chance at having a family. Specifically, siblings are a great example. Being adopted as a sibling set can be more challenging. Children who are older are a priority for gift of adoption and vulnerable at risk of never having a family.
Sorry, Pam, can I ask you a quick question? If you're adopting siblings, does that mean it's also double the cost? Or if you're adopting more than one child, I assume those costs go up?
You know, it is a little bit. The costs are a little bit higher for adopting siblings, yes.
So it is the costs go up as if you are trying to adopt, like, for example, two children together who are siblings.
It tends to. I mean, even just the criteria of travel. It's just
sure.
one more person
right.
traveling.
Right.
But yeah, I think the providers do a phenomenal job of really, you know, nonprofits or organizations that are completing adoptions in the state of Illinois, all the agencies, for example, are, you know, certified nonprofits. I mean, they're really doing their best to help families get across the finish line and get children into these amazing homes.
Mm-hmm. So you were saying children who are siblings, also I guess that's a priority of vulnerable. What are other conditions that make children vulnerable?
Right. So I think if you have special needs, I think also that can sometimes make a child vulnerable, and there aren't as many families who are stepping forward to adopt children with special needs, I think, if children are older. And then also, when we think about domestic adoption, there are children who are sometimes, there's a birth plan being made in the hospital, so they might be in the NICU. And one of the priorities Gift of Adoption has is really seeing if we can have a child go home from the NICU with a private adoption, if that's what the birth parents are supporting, rather than going into a temporary or a regular foster care system. So children who are at risk of entering foster care or aging out of foster care are the last group of priorities for us.
And when you say older children, at what age do you think are we seeing it give children here? At what age is it where you're seeing not as many families families are stepping up?
Right. The Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption does really a lot of great research on this. I think they would say the age of 7 to 9 becomes really difficult. When you're sort of over that age, it becomes more difficult to be adopted.
And would you say that for that age group, this might be, as you said, their last, or is it their only chance in some cases for adoption for some of these older children?
Yeah, I mean, we really see ourselves as really working for children. And so, yeah, we really feel like a child who is getting older, then there's the numbers of families who are moving forward to adopt older children is a smaller group of families. And so, yeah, I mean, we always have hope for all kids, and some of the priorities we've rushed both domestically and internationally is when the child is literally on the cusp of that birth date. I mean, and Gaz, you talked about turning 39. If you're in certain countries at age 13, that's kind of the age in which, you know, you are no longer eligible to be adopted and age out of an orphanage. So we really pay attention to those critical tipping point times for kids just to be sure we're really helping families, you know, disrupt what would otherwise happen and get these children into a really awesome home.
Pam, you mentioned international adoptions versus domestic adoptions. What do we see in the U.S.? Are more people adopting children domestically or internationally?
By far domestic. Probably in the United States. The U.S. is the most adoptive country of all, and I think, you know, latest numbers are somewhere around 100 to 120,000 adoptions a year around the U.S., with Americans stepping forward to adopt, and probably 5 or 6,000 of these adoptions are international, so mm-hmm. It's a very small portion. I think there's visibility with internationally adopted families, and I think there's a lot of celebrities who've adopted internationally, so it has sort of an eye. But by far, most adoptions are foster care, relative adoptions, step-parent adoptions, and then private adoptions like Ngozi.
Ngozi, you talked in the beginning about the whole process, how much learning you had to do, the whole process you went through before you started this. Is there anything you wish you would have known that you before you started this, or anything you want to share for people who are thinking about this?
Actually, to answer that question truthfully, no. And I say no because the incredible process of learning that I went through from, and I'm not just talking about the home study, but actually going through my own failed pregnancies, the IVF process, all of it, I've become an expert in the realm of if you're suffering fertility problems, if you are, if you want to go through IVF, if you want to adopt, and I've become an excellent resource for my own family and friends, and then an expanding network of women who just learn of my story and come to me and ask me questions. I also wanted to comment very quickly on what Pam said about international adoption. As you can probably tell by my name, my parents were born and raised in Nigeria. So initially I was interested in possibly adopting internationally from Nigeria. And as Pam indicated, the hurdles are amazing. And we talked about the age of children aging out at 13. In some countries, you age out in terms of being an adoptive parent at 40. sometimes younger than that.
So even so, okay.
So it there are challenges in that regard. That's why I'm so supportive of Gift of Adoption, the work that they do, and the education and outreach that they engage in, because there are so many people who have thought of adoption. They just think of it as insurmountable in terms of the cost, or it's just not. It's too hard. It's not. And I want as many of these children that Pam refers to as possible to have a home like my son. And also, I just wanted to add the element of being a person of color, being a black woman in this country, and adopting a black child. Just yesterday, there's a small group of us, of six women, we're all professionals. Some are attorneys like me and other professionals. We all met 4 years ago, right before I entered the adoption process, and they were as well. And we all adopted children, children of color. And we share our stories, and we meet regularly, and we want the children to get to know one another, because we recognize that we can serve the purpose of educating our own networks and expanding just this gift to other children. So this has become a mission of mine, and I'm so very grateful to Gift of Adoption.
Well, we're grateful to you for sharing your story. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us. That's Ngozi Okorafor, as she's saying, sharing the story of her family, how her family came together 4 years ago. I want to thank also Pam Devereaux with Gift of Adoption. They're a national organization based in Chicago. This month, they've been awarding grants to one family a day throughout the November to help with financial assistance. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you kindly.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, we're going to continue this conversation with talking specifically about Illinois adoptions with the executive director of the Adoption Center of Illinois. We're also going to be joined by Representative Rodney Davis, who's proposing some legislation to help adoptive families with tax credits. So stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. We're talking about adoption. We just finished speaking with an adoptive mother from Chicago about her experience, as well as the organization that won an organization that helped her with financial support, Gift of Adoption, a national group also based in Chicago. We're joined now by Jane Turner. She's executive director of the Adoption Center of Illinois, that's based at the Family Resource Center. They're a private child welfare agency in Illinois, and they help parents through the adoption process. Jane, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Jane, I wonder, you do a lot of counseling for families. What kind of questions do families normally come to? We heard Ngozi talk about the process that she went through. I wonder if you could walk us through that a little bit more.
Sure. I think that some people come in with a very specific focus. I know that I want to adopt a special needs child from China. Right, it's like, okay, very clear cut, and here's the steps you go to. Other people say, I know I'd like to adopt a newborn born here in Illinois, right? And that's a very specific process. But a lot of people say, tell me about adoption. And
what do you say when they say that to you? What do you say to them?
Well, that's when I start asking them questions. Well, what is your vision? If you had to imagine this, the situations that you'd be interested in, what do you see as the oldest child you'd be open to? What do you see as the youngest child? What health issues might you be open to? What background of the child? So it gets to be very personal. There is no, when someone says, I'd like to adopt, there is no one right answer. So I think that I would encourage people to have an individual consultation. You got to get to know them. You have to understand their circumstances, their finances, their personalities, their family support to understand what type of adoption would be a right fit. It is certainly not one size fits all.
And how do you counsel families to make sure they're with reputable agencies? What should families know in terms of looking for accredited agencies and all of those sorts of things?
Sure. Well, what's nice about Illinois, I'm very proud to be an Illinois agency because there was some adoption legislation several years ago, and now every agency must be 501c3 not-for-profit. So there was a lot of agencies that had been doing things that didn't feel financially comfortable with the adoption community, and they're no longer serving our families. So the Illinois agencies, if you go to your DCFS website, there's a list of Illinois adoption agencies, and every one of those is vetted very well by the state, and I think you could feel good about them. If you're looking at international adoption, there's something called the Hague Accreditation on International Adoption, and the Council on Accreditation accredits every single agency that is involved in international adoption. So you can look to them as kind of the seal of approval as well. So there's not, especially in Illinois, there's not a little, you know, quote-unquote fly-by-night agencies. People are very well vetted here in Illinois.
Mm-hmm. And then we've been talking about, you've been sort of talking about all of the emotional and logistical things. We were spending some time at the beginning of this hour talking about the financial costs, and I think some people might be surprised to know the costs as being as high as perhaps $25,000, more than that, when we're looking at international adoptions. I just wonder, what kind of support... you know, we heard about Gift of Adoption. That's one agency that's trying to help family with financial need. What other support do you think families should be looking for?
Well, actually, $25,000 is actually a conservative number.
That's conservative.
Actually,
wow. So how much would you say for a domestic? What number would you think?
For a domestic Illinois placement of a newborn, it's probably going to be closer to $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
But
wow.
That's, you know, and that, but in, and then some states, there's private attorneys in other states, and the cost could be, you know, $40,000 or $50,000. So it's very, it's extremely varied. But when people say, well, how much is an adoption cost? I say the range is zero on up.
And how, so, right. So can you take us through that? So where would it, how would it go from zero to on up?
Okay. If you adopt a child from the foster care system, there are no, you will not pay directly from DCFS with the support of the state. You will not pay any dollars. In fact, the vast majority of the children, if not all the children, will come with an adoption subsidy, whereby adoptive parents may receive, will be receiving support from the state after the adoption each month until the child becomes an adult.
Mm, okay.
So you are not paying for that home study, and you are not paying any adoption fees, and even the attorney fees can be covered by the state if you're adopting through the state. So children from the so people adopting through the foster care system, there are, the fees are completely different. The fees that are expensive is when it's a private adoption of an individual birth mom who places with through a private agency, and then international adoption is going to be quite different. There may be certain agencies that have a lot of have grants associated with the special needs children particularly, and those may be a lot less, but international adoption can be kind of on the high end as well.
And Jane, when we're thinking about Illinois, around how many children are in Illinois right now waiting to be adopted?
You know, it's just on Thursday, on Thanksgiving Day, there was a beautiful article right on the front page of the Tribune. I was so happy to see good news for Thanksgiving. And it says, on this Thanksgiving, a grateful new family. And it actually mentioned the fact that at any given time in Illinois, there's over 1,000 children waiting to be adopted in the foster care system.
Wow, in the foster care system. Okay. And
correct.
Do we know how, are there more children in Illinois compared to other states? Do we know how Illinois... what the need is like here compared to other parts of the country?
Well, there's a wonderful website called Adopt U.S. Kids, and it has lists of waiting children all over the country. And there, on their website, it mentions that there's over 100,000 kids waiting to be adopted. So if you look at the, if there's 50 states, I don't know. The problem with the DCFS number is that it's not a hard number.
Sure.
Because some people might be living with their grandmother and they're waiting to be adopted. But if it's a grandparent or a kinship adoption, it's going to feel differently than a child in the foster care system that's going to be leaving that familiar home and going to a new family. So it's you have to look at kind of the specifics.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask, you know, a question that I was posing to Nguzi and to Pam from Gift of Adoption about what kind of advice you would offer to people who were thinking about this. What would you say to people who are maybe listening to this and maybe have been thinking about it and don't much maybe or just starting to learn or at the beginning part of this process? What would you say to them?
I would say what you want to do is find a home base. Find an agency or an adoption professional in your area that you feel that will be there to support you, that can, that will connect with you, that will be available to you to answer your questions and get you through the journey. And being in Illinois, there's wonderful agencies that serve the whole state. I'm very proud of ours serving the whole state, but there's also other agencies that may just serve one portion of the state. So find somebody that you feel comfortable with. And also, you know, talk to your friends and relatives. Hey, you know, I'm thinking about adoption. Who do you recommend? And ask the agency for recommendations and for references as well.
One last question for you, Jean. We're about to be joined by Representative Rodney Davis. He's proposing some legislation that aims to help adoptive families, some of whom can experience delays when it comes to filing taxes, as we've been sort of talking about the finances of adoption, because their adoptive child's Social Security number has been compromised. That would be because of a biological parent continuing to claim the child as a dependent. Do we know how common this issue is? Is this something that's an issue that people need to be concerned about?
I think it's very important, but I think it's fairly rare. When I heard about this legislation, I thought back to all the families we've served, and I've been with the agency for almost 28 years. And I can only think of maybe this, I've heard about this two or three times. So it's, but for those two or three people, this is a very important thing, just because it doesn't happen all the time. I applaud and support any legislation that supports adoptive families to make their adoption secure and to make their whole process smooth. So I think that's terrific. But I wouldn't say that if people are thinking about adoption, that they should be concerned about, Social Security numbers being compromised as a major focus of concern.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. That's Jane Turner. She's Executive Director of the Adoption Center of Illinois at the Family Resource Center. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you so much.
Representative Rodney Davis is on the line and joins us now. Representative Davis, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
So,
I appreciate the
time. Yeah, what brought this issue to your attention?
Caller.
Yeah, I was going to say, what brought those? She was just saying it's maybe not necessarily a common problem, but an important one. How did this catch your attention?
You know what? How did the issue get to my attention?
Yeah, this proposed legislation.
Yeah, the issue was one of my constituents who had adopted children came into my office and said this has been an ongoing problem for her and her family. And I agree with your last interviewee that, you know, even if it happens to one person, it's too much. And what happened with this family was every year the biological mother would claim that child tax credit and file her tax forms before the adoptive parent was able to. And then, unfortunately, under current law, it became the adoptive parent's responsibility to prove that she was the one who deserved that tax credit.
Okay.
And the unfortunate thing is that the IRS still would not go after those who would fraudulently file year after year. And it shouldn't take this legislation, but it did.
And so what was your legislation, what you're proposing, this is H.R. 6238, what would this do?
Well, what it would do is make the IRS do their job. The IRS should not allow fraudulent child tax credits to go out to adoptive parents who don't legally have the right to claim that child tax credit. And the IRS, especially when it comes to adoptive parents, should be able to go after those who are committing that fraud, too, and they're not doing that. In this legislation, we're encouraging them to do that. We would make them, in my opinion, do their job. And also, this legislation is going to make it easier for adoptive parents to be able to utilize a PIN, utilize new technology to be able to be sure that they are the ones who deserve that child tax credit. And this would create a process that's already in place for other governmental agencies, and we would use this type of PIN technology with that certain tax form too, and then take the problem away from families like my constituent who came in and has had this happen year after year after year.
Mm-hmm. Representative Davis, I wonder if we can just switch topics for a minute and just ask you, because of the news that we heard this weekend, the death of Cuban leader Fidel Castro. I know you've traveled to Cuba several times, first in 2005, then again in 2015. I wonder, what was your first thought this weekend when you heard that Fidel Castro had finally died?
Well, I'm optimistic for the Cuban people. That was my first thought, that finally we can turn the page on this brutal dictator who took a country that is so close to our southern coast and turned it into a nation that still, unfortunately, lives decades behind us because of his failed policies and his own ego that only led to his power. I'm optimistic that new leadership will want to work with us as the United States to begin to open up more economic opportunities. But those economic opportunities have to come from a willingness from the Cuban government to want to have more openness and more economic relations with us. Because, frankly, since the president opened up more opportunities for us to trade with each other, the Cuban government's the one who has shut down those opportunities more than the U.S. has.
Right. And I know you've been very supportive of President Obama's efforts to open up economic relations. Are you concerned that President-elect Trump might try to reverse those executive orders?
Well, I think we have a tremendous opportunity under the new administration to really set rules in place that are going to force the Cuban officials to do what's best for their people. And right now, a lot of folks don't understand that there are two currencies that are used in the country of Cuba. One that tourists have to use, the tourist peso, that's always valued at less than the American dollar, so you pay a penalty when you cash a dollar in. And then there's the peso, the regular Cuban peso, that the Cuban people get paid with, and it's valued much, much less than that Cuban tourist peso. They need to combine that currency so that when we have more economic trade, when we have more tourists go into Cuba and spend their money, that the money actually goes down into the Cuban population. Because right now, if a tourist or a government official like me goes to Cuba, we cash in a dollar for a Cuban tourist peso. We get about 85 cents on that dollar. And that money can only be spent at certain stores where the government and the military have control over those dollars. And it's not going to trickle down to the Cuban people until we see those currencies combined. And that was my number one issue that I addressed with the Cuban government when I was there in 2015.
You know, as we're talking about trade, this is something that's been important for you, supporting trade opportunities, not just with Cuba, with other countries. We're thinking about the agriculture that we produce in Illinois, our major companies like Caterpillar and ADM that depend very much on these international trade agreements. And I wonder, with President-elect Trump promising to get much tougher with some of our biggest trading partners, how do you plan to protect access to these important markets for Illinois exporters?
Well, number one, we've got to get Cuba up to where they can actually...
Oh, I mean other countries as well, yeah. Though, apart from Cuba. I'm just talking about other trade agreements as
sure.
well.
Sure. When it comes to Cuba, though, we've got to get them at a point where they can afford to buy American products. The fact is, you know, you go to a Cuban farm and you see 40 to 50-year-old Russian technology as their best tractor. You know, they've been left behind because Fidel Castro created a system of government that forced them to be left behind. Now, when it comes to trade agreements, I think the president-elect has talked about having more bilateral trade agreements, which I think works well for a country like Cuba, especially in a post-Fidel Castro era, where we might see some new leaders come through that are going to encourage Raul Castro to actually open up trade. When it comes to other trade agreements, I think you're probably going to look at more bilateral agreements in a Trump administration rather than a multilateral agreement like the TPP, which was not supported by either side and, frankly, was not pushed enough by the Obama administration within his own party to even make it palatable enough to even pass.
So your focus will be on making sure that those agreements continue, whether they're through bilateral means, it sounds
we
like.
We have to have global trade in the global marketplace. You know, frankly, we can't sell as many mining trucks in the United States as we used to because the federal government over the last 8 years has said we're going to mine less in this country. So the only way to keep my constituents who are United Auto Workers employed at our Decatur Caterpillar facility making mining trucks is to sell them overseas. Mm. And that means we've got to have more bilateral agreements to do so.
Thanks so much for joining us. Representative Rodney Davis represents parts of Central Illinois from Bloomington to Edwardsville. Thank you for taking time.
Thanks for having me.
thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's becoming hard to distinguish actual news from fake news, especially if you're on social media platforms like Facebook. Maybe you've seen the real news story since the election about the fake news stories that were completely false but went viral. And it's all raised concerns about the impact that had, not just on us understanding information, but even the outcome of our presidential elections. Here are some facts for you. More than 40% of Americans get their news on Facebook. And a recent study from Stanford University found that more than 80% of middle school students could not distinguish between sponsored content, which is advertising, and actual news stories. Facebook and Google say they've been working on an adequate way to fix this, but in just a day and a half, a few University of Illinois students came up with their own solution. Xingling Chen and Mark Kraft are both sophomores at the University of Illinois, and at a hackathon in Princeton, in 36 hours, they've come up with a solution to help Facebook's fake news problem. They're in studio with me now. Hey, guys, welcome to The 21st.
Hi, thank you for inviting us.
Yep, thank you for having us.
This is a Chrome extension. Mark, how does it work?
So you just have to download our Chrome extension, and then when you open up any Facebook page, it takes all the contents, looks through if there's any pictures or links, and then it'll send it to our server, which will then check if it's first a safe site or not by checking a database of phishing and malware sites, and then it'll go through Google Safe Browsing and also Bing Search to see whether or not the information in the articles are true or not.
So, Xingling, can anyone use this? Is this something you just have to install this into? You have to use Chrome as a browser, right?
Yeah, it's available on the web store.
Okay. So if you just look on the Google App Store, you can. And what's it called?
It's FIB, F-I-B.
F-I-B. Okay, well, That's an easy thing for everybody to remember. I'm curious for you guys, as a journalist, obviously, this is something that's really important to me. I spent a lot of time looking at sources. But for you guys, what was it about this that you thought we need to work on this?
So we saw recently people were upset about the elections. There were like fake news spreading throughout social media such as Facebook. And so we decided we wanted to tackle this issue.
And Xingling, did you just think Facebook says they're going to fix it? They really haven't gotten around to, you know, they said, Mark Zuckerberg said, we're working on this. You know, and they've said that they take this seriously and they say anything that's fake gets penalized. But did you guys just think we could probably come up with a better solution for this that doesn't rely on Facebook?
We just want to give a solution. But interestingly, the day we released our project, Mark Zuckerberg said 99% of Facebook news is authentic. So later, Mark Zuckerberg said they're going to come up with a solution. So we think our project has some effect.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. And what about for you guys, what do you think about, I think it's hard because how are you distinguishing between what's fake and what's not? How did you decide the parameters of that?
So there's different things we checked. So if it's a fact, we could Google search and the Bing search to see the top five most trustworthy sites to cross-check whether or not the facts are true.
And what are the top five most trustworthy sites?
It depends. We have a database of trustworthy sites using an API called Web of Trust, which has already been out there for a long time. And so it's the top five sites that show up when we search for the key points and key terms inside the article.
Okay, so I'm speaking with Xingling Chen and Mark Kraft. Both of them are sophomores at the University of Illinois. They were part of a team that came up with an app. As you heard, you can download it from the Google App Store. It's called FIB, and it will help install in your browser a way to distinguish between fake and real news sources. I want to bring someone else into this conversation. Nicole Cook is an assistant professor at the School of Information Sciences at the University of Illinois. Nicole, you're in here nodding as the students are talking about how they they've coded out technology to kind of separate out sources. I wonder how you think librarians are thinking about this, because I think certainly from a technological standpoint, this is something that you guys are also spending a lot of time thinking about.
Oh, absolutely. And I think for librarians, this is really interesting for us, this particular point in time, because we've been talking about fake news and fake websites for many years.
And now people are finally paying attention.
Right. And it's, you know, we do it manually. I think this is wonderful, the app. But we've been talking in our classes and in our organizations and our libraries for many years, telling people how to manually, if you will, do the same thing that this app is doing? How do you look at a site and evaluate it to see if it's quality, if it's worth time? You know, there's been many satire sites, The Onion, et cetera, many fake websites. Storm Center is a white supremacist site that we've been using that example for many years. You know, what are the things that you check to see if this is fake news, if this is propaganda, if this is very biased information?
So for you guys, Mark and Qingling, are you looking at URLs? Because I think a lot of times when we've seen, for example, abc.co, right, mm-hmm. is a fake site and people mm-hmm. might. Do you think, are you guys looking at particularly URLs as well to determine whether or not they're for real or fake?
Yeah, we kind of like get the URL of the news, new feeds of the posts of Facebook.
Right. So you're looking at that as a source. Nicole, what are other ways? I mean, obviously looking at the URL of a site is kind of a obvious first line right. thing you can do. What else do you think for people who are trying to do this manually?
Sure.
What other things are important for them?
Look at the date. You know, sometimes a lot of times with fake news, things are retread and you'll see posts that are
it's like
old,
a three-year-old
thing. And people are saying, oh, this happened today. No, it didn't. Another thing is to pay attention to the language. Sometimes the fake news and the satire sites will use very absolute language. All minorities do this and all of these things will last forever. So the language becomes much more subjective, right? Real news aspires to have more objective language. Another thing is triangulation. Are you seeing this information in more than one place? Right. So the problem with Facebook and some of the other sites is that people are very quick to share something and they're not actually going a couple layers deeper to find out where.
Right. So they're sharing. Maybe they haven't even read the actual
absolutely.
Story.
Absolutely.
And then what are other layers? So the first thing would be obviously read the actual story before
yes.
you share something. What else?
Go to Google. Everyone loves Google and see if it comes up someplace else. Do you see it in the New York Times and the Washington Post and someplace else? Or you just can you only find this information in one place?
Mark, is this something you do when you're on Facebook, or do you ever when you I don't know how often you guys are on Facebook. Is that where you get your news from?
I personally never get my news from Facebook.
You don't. Where do you get your news from?
Well, I just like Google search and then see a bunch of different like articles that I know are more
right.
trustworthy.
Qingling, what about you? Where do you get your news from?
Mostly it's like from like very reliable like news like
okay
times.
So also not really from Facebook, I guess it sounds like mm-hmm. both of you guys are doing your own searches. Nicole, what would you recommend for people who because the thing is everybody does Facebook is for better or worse a platform that people are sharing news from. We've seen that from the Pew Research, how much that number has gone up
right.
over time.
Right.
So for people who are on Facebook, what or people who are looking at Twitter or whatever other social media platform they're using for sharing, what would you suggest are kind of basic steps that everybody should take?
I think the first step and maybe one of the easiest things is just to recognize that we all have like a cognitive bias. We tend to gravitate towards information that confirms what we already know and what we already believe. And it's very easy to get stuck in a filter bubble or this echo chamber. And when you get caught in that, you tend not to question. Right. So just the idea that people should be aware that you may be getting a particular view from your feed and just to search more broadly and to read more widely. And then you'll start seeing different things. And then just really pay attention and just click the links and, you know, read the article before you share it.
Mark, was this something you were concerned about before the election?
So we didn't actually have this. We came up with this idea on the spot. So I didn't think of this as much before.
And this was at a hackathon you guys were at Princeton. Can you tell me more about that?
Yep. So this is a 36-hour hackathon at Princeton. So we had from 9 p.m. on Friday to 9 a.m. on Sunday to work on any project we wanted, either software or hardware. And we decided to do a software hack, and we created Fib.
Nicole, as we're thinking about this, I wonder what you think the role of, I think a lot of people, you know, we've talked about the role of technology. I talk about the role of journalism all the time. What do you think the role of librarians is in all of this?
Librarians are there to help people navigate resources, find them and also navigate them. And we do that in a variety of different settings, as you know, university library, school libraries, K-12. That's where a lot of this happens. It's important to get students aware of fake news and this type of critical thinking early on. But your local public library, Champaign Public, Urbana Free, have some awesome people there that are waiting to answer people's questions about, you know, if you have some doubts about information, they're there to help you navigate all of these things. And we always pay a lot of attention to technology and the speed at which things are coming through, information overload, et cetera. And that's what we've been doing. That's what we do in terms of trying to help people parse, right? So you don't have to do it by yourself if you have questions.
And do you think, especially for children, do you think that, I wonder who you think that role should be in an educational system for sort of teaching children, as we're looking at the Stanford study, right, which just came out last week. I think it actually came out last Tuesday, about looking, for example, at middle school students and their inability to do exactly what you're saying,
mm-hmm,
filter out,
mm-hmm,
and say, this looks exactly like a news story, but it's paid for the person that's paid by someone to, mm-hmm, present this, mm-hmm, information. It's not unbiased journalism, independent journalism.
Right.
Do you think librarians should be doing that? Do you think schools should be doing this, parents?
I think all of the above. You know, that's traditionally the school librarian's role, amongst the many other things that they do. But in terms of the classroom, you know, are children having civic lessons the way that we used to many years ago? Are they studying social science and political science in their classrooms? And certainly there's a role for parents to say, you know, hey, you know, what are you looking at, and how do we determine whether this is something you should be paying attention to? So I think everyone should play a role.
And how are you training librarians at University of Illinois to kind of work on this,
mm-hmm,
right? Particularly librarians that are out in different communities. As you know, you mentioned Champaign-Urbana, the Champaign-Urbana area libraries all across,
right,
Illinois, right?
Yes.
Are good resources for this. How are you all training librarians?
We have a specific class. We have certainly lots of classes, but we have a specific class that we engage in information literacy instruction. And so these are the types of things that we talk about. And we talk about not only how do we know how to distinguish the real from the fake, but pedagogically, how do we then go into our communities and teach our patrons and teach our students and folks that are using the library how to engage in this critical thinking. So we explicitly tackle this.
And do you feel like enough conversation is happening now? Do you feel like this is ironically maybe created a moment where people are actually talking about this?
I do think so. What I would love to see is that this conversation be prolonged, right? And so hopefully, you know, this is a hot topic right now, and that we'll be able to continue this conversation and it won't just kind of fall by the wayside when the next topic comes up.
Yeah. Mark, what's next for you guys with FIB? Like, I don't know if you guys have heard from Facebook. Did you just kind of create it and now the technology is sitting there? What are you guys planning to do next?
So we're still trying to improve our project, because right now it only works for Chrome. So we want to expand it so it works in Firefox or any other browsers.
Safari, right.
Safari, yep.
Okay. And how long do you think that will take?
It'll take as long as we need to spend time to learn how to do it. But it shouldn't take that long, because we were able to come up with this Chrome extension in 36 hours.
Right.
When we've never created a Chrome extension before.
Okay. So are you hoping someone else might pick this up too then?
Yep. So our project is open source. So we're hoping the community will help us improve this app.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Again, as Mark was just saying, it's called FIB. If you look for it on the Google App Store, that's Mark Kraft. He's a sophomore in systems engineering and design at the University of Illinois. Xingling Chen is also a sophomore, part of the team of four students that came up with this. I want to thank Nicole Cook as well, who's an associate professor at the School of Information Sciences at the U of I. Thanks for being with me, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows for us on the NPR One app if you search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every other way to contact us, whether it's phone, email, or social media, is all at our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background on what we're talking about, more context for you. When we're not on the air, you can follow our handle for all Illinois news. On our Facebook page, if you search for The 21st to like us, you can comment on what we're working on. That's also where you can post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Howla Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft, with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Stay tuned tomorrow. Speaking of apps, we're going to be talking about some new apps hoping to work against and prevent sexual assault, particularly on college campuses. So stay tuned for that. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.